This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Our first question is from Millie, and she'd emailed to ask, "Hello, we've been studying the theory of relativity in physics for GCSE, and I was wondering whether you could answer my question." Well, Tim is here to answer them for you. The question is, if there were two atomic clocks, one on Earth and one in a spaceship travelling near the speed of light, if the people on the Earth could see the people on the spaceship, would they have the appearance of moving slower, or would they be moving at the same as the people on the Earth, only thinking their clock is slow?
Right, okay, so good question from Millie. For those who aren't British, the GCSEs are exams that are taken by students at school at the age of about 15, basically. This is an effect called time dilation, which is more simply said as moving clocks run slow. And I guess the confusion here is that that phrase itself, moving clocks run slow, might make people think that it's all just about clocks. So clocks sort of tick more slowly. And I think this is the problem that Millie's having, is that she's imagining the spaceship whizzing past. And yeah, you know, you'd have to sort of be able to imagine that we could somehow see the people on the spaceship through a window in some sense, and maybe see the clock on the wall or something that was connected to the very accurate atomic clock. And certainly if they're travelling very fast, then that clock will tick slowly. We would see it ticking more slowly than our clocks on Earth. And of course, it's not just the clocks, it is the people. So the people would be moving around more slowly. If they were moving, you know, sort of as we looked at them, if they were moving at the same speed as we are here on Earth, then they'd be sort of moving super fast relative to their own clocks. So that's not really possible. So they're not super beings. So as normal human beings on the spaceship, they would actually be moving, you know, at, you know, walking speed of sort of, you know, half a meter per second or whatever walking speed is. They would be moving half a meter per second relative to their clocks. So because their clocks are slow, they'd be moving more slowly than normal. So yeah, we do see them move more slowly. I mean, often we think of these sort of weird examples that we can't, you know, there aren't spaceships whizzing fast at almost the speed of light that we can see through the windows and see people inside. But there are real life examples of this effect, and a really good one to think about is satellite navigation. So GPS satellites that you might have a sat-nav system in a car that you travel in. It turns out because those satellites are moving you know, reasonably high speed, it turns out those clocks will be ticking more slowly than they should be. Turns out they lose about 7 microseconds a day relative to clocks on the Earth, which is a measurable amount of time. Okay, 7 millionths of a second is not much, but it's a measurable amount of time. It turns out that if you don't correct for that that time difference, you would get your position on Earth wrong. Now, as it turns out, not only do we have to correct for this effect, time dilation, which is Einstein's special theory of relativity, we also have to correct for a time difference due to his general theory of relativity, which is all about the warping of space-time by mass. And because these spacecraft are above the Earth's surface, they're feeling a different sort of gravitational pull. Turns out that makes the clocks run faster by 45 microseconds per day. So if you combine the two, faster by 45 microseconds and slower by 7 microseconds, you end up with these clocks on board these spacecraft moving, ticking faster by 38 microseconds a day. And if you didn't correct for that, you would gradually accumulate more and more errors in your position in your sat-nav on your car at the level of 10 kilometres a day.
Wow.
So this is a significant effect. So, you know, you really do have to use both time dilation in special relativity and gravitational effects in general relativity to correct for clock speeds. Otherwise, even your car satellite navigation would be useless.
Wow, can you imagine how many people getting lost if these weren't corrected then?
Yeah, it's bad enough with normal sat-nav, but it'd be even worse if you didn't correct for relativity.
Our second question is from Rupin, and he says, is there a limit to how much matter a black hole can suck up?
I guess I always worry when people think about black holes sucking up material, because I always think that in your head there's this picture of the black hole as some sort of cosmic vacuum cleaner that races around space hoovering things up and sucking everything into it. And I think this is the wrong picture, of course. So it doesn't really suck things up. It does have gravity, and things, if they were just sat there in space, they could fall into a black hole. But mostly things are moving, so things are often orbiting black holes, and that doesn't mean that they just immediately get sucked up. And my classic example is turning the sun into a black hole. If you just turn the sun into a black hole now, the Earth wouldn't get sucked into it. We wouldn't just get hoovered up immediately by the sun turning into a black hole. We would continue to orbit it just the same as we do currently. It would get dark in 8 minutes' time, and we would all die, but we wouldn't get sucked into the black hole. So bearing that in mind, and answering the question, is there a limit to how much matter a black hole can suck up? Well, if we could sort of feed the black hole and keep feeding it, then I don't suppose in principle there is really any limit, except that in practice, when we look around the universe and we try and find black holes, the biggest black holes, the most massive black holes we find, are in the middle of galaxies. So we think a lot of galaxies have these supermassive black holes at their cores. In the middle of our galaxy, in the middle of the Milky Way, we think there's a black hole. There's good evidence for that by looking at the motions of stars around the black hole in the middle of our galaxy that seems to put its mass at about 4 million times the mass of the Sun. So this is a pretty massive black hole, okay? There are other galaxies, active galaxies, quasars and so on, where it looks like the mass of the black hole might be as much as a billion times the mass of the Sun, so 1,000 million times the mass of the Sun. But there's some evidence that the most massive black holes in these galaxies are only about maybe 10 billion times the mass of the Sun. Now, it seems that perhaps that as an upper limit, that probably comes because you've got to keep feeding the black hole to make its mass increase. And it looks like perhaps as the black hole gets more and more massive, maybe what happens is the region of space, the sort of swirling matter that's falling in towards the event horizon, the black hole, that's getting very hot as stuff falls in towards it. And maybe that actually acts as a sort of a switch that switches off the feeding process, that turns off the way in which we actually add mass to the black hole. Maybe that would actually provide a natural upper limit to the mass of a black hole of about 10 billion. And just while we're talking about black holes, I should say that we're talking about black holes getting more and more massive as they feed. Actually, if you go to the other end of the scale on black holes, if you go to small black holes, they actually shrink. So black holes actually shrink rather than grow. And the reason is because of something called Hawking radiation that you might guess is named after the famous physicist Stephen Hawking. And he realized, it must be more than 30 years ago now, I guess, early 70s, that actually it was possible, if you allow for this quantum mechanical effect of producing particle-antiparticle pairs out of the vacuum, so you might produce a positron and an electron, if you do that near a black hole, then what can happen is that one of these particles can fall into the black hole and the other particle can escape. So instead of sort of a black hole effectively being black completely, the region around the event horizon can actually have this radiation glowing from it, you know, particles coming from the region around the event horizon. That actually results in energy can't come from nowhere. So it sounds like we're cheating and we're not conserving energy here. It turns out that that's results in the mass of the black hole decreasing. So as it sort of radiates away energy through Hawking radiation, it actually shrinks and its mass goes down. It turns out that for most black holes, the lifetime, if you allow for all this sort of losing mass due to Hawking radiation, is vastly longer than the age of the universe, so we don't have to worry. But for small mass black holes, then their age might be about the age of the universe. And it turns out a black hole of mass, about 1 million kilograms, so that's a 1 followed by 12 zeros, has a lifetime that's about the age of the universe. Does that sound like a very massive black hole to you?
It sounds very, very, very heavy.
So it does. So a million kilograms sounds like a big number. But actually, it turns out, I was just working out some numbers fast, thinking,
what's million kilograms?
Yeah, so a million kilograms is about the mass of, if you could get a body of water that had, that was a few kilometres across, right? A volume of water that was a few kilometres across, that would weigh, that's mass, would be about 1 million kilograms.
Wow.
So it's actually just the mass of a small lake, really. So it's not a very huge mass on astrophysical terms. And it turns out, you know, if that were a black hole, if one could take that and turn it into a black hole, you'd have to squidge it down to a size that was only about 10 to the minus 15 meters. Now, that's sort of a very small number, very tiny fraction of a meter, about the size of an atomic nucleus. So you take this small lake, squidge it down to be the size of an atomic nucleus, you've got a black hole of that mass, and its lifetime's about the age of the universe. So those things would be dying now, effectively, evaporating now, as we say. And they should be, we might even be able to see them by a sort of flash of, a little flash of gamma rays as they wink out of existence, basically. But yeah, so black holes, looks like the biggest black holes, maybe 10 billion solar masses, probably because somehow the way in which they're fed is being switched off. Somebody's cutting off the food supply. But small black holes actually shrink naturally by Hawking radiation and evaporate and disappear in a puff of gamma rays.
Wow, the life and death of black holes. On to the next question, which is from Jerry. And he wrote in to say, if the universe had originated at a single point with the Big Bang, and it had been expanding ever since, then should it not simply be an expanding spherical shell rather than essentially continuous mass? Also, although there are slight variations in the cosmic microwave background, shouldn't there be a definite thermal gradient across the universe as a result of the expansion?
There's a problem here in the sense that it's a sort of misunderstanding about the Big Bang, really, which is that saying if the universe originated at a single point with the Big Bang. I think that's a confusing thing to say, actually, because it does lead to this sort of picture that there's a single point that one could sit outside, look at from a distance. Everything expands from that point. And he's in this case, his interpretation is that you would see the universe as a sort of this expanding spherical shell of material moving away from this point. Clearly, the universe isn't like that. And in fact, the problem is that the universe, in a sense, didn't begin at a single point with the Big Bang. The Big Bang happened everywhere in the universe. So we might have, I would, you know, encourage you, Jerry, to think about it as, imagine that the universe might be infinite. Hard to imagine, maybe, but it just goes on forever. I sometimes think it's harder to imagine that the universe might be finite and have an edge. That's a bit harder to imagine, because what's outside it? But that's perhaps for another question. But let's imagine for the moment that the universe is infinite, goes on forever, and that you think of two points within the universe. There might be two galaxies, let's say, and then you sort of wind back the clock and they come closer and closer together until at some point in the past those two points are at the same point. But then you've got to think of another two points, think of another galaxy even farther away than the first pair, and think about those points shrinking back together again. And you could do the same out for infinity, effectively, with larger and larger distances between the points and just shrinking them all back down. But as soon as you imagine that and then imagine the Big Bang happening from that point where all these points were together, then you're inside that universe. There's not a single spherical shell. You're not looking at it from the outside. You're inside this potentially infinite universe, and then you still would have this continuous distribution of matter, albeit the average density of that matter is going down and down as the universe gets bigger and bigger. And I think the same point really answers his second comment about shouldn't there be sort of a temperature gradient, you know, the temperature gradually changes across the universe as a result of this expansion. Well, once you sort of realize that, you know, the Big Bang happened everywhere in the universe as we see it now, then I think you realize that there shouldn't then obviously be no difference between one point in the universe compared to another point in the universe. The conditions, you know, way back then or at the time of the Big Bang would be the same because they were all effectively in the same place and they've just sort of spread farther apart now. I hope that answers his question.
I was just hoping for another current bun example so I could get more cake at Jogcast pubs, which was really, really delicious, by the way.
I missed out on the cake.
On the cake.
The infinite cake that was brought to Jod Pub.
Yes, oh, it was a very good cake. So, please, more cake questions. And the final question this month is for Marie. And Marie says, like lots of people, I'm really intrigued by the newly identified planet in the Goldilocks zone of the star Galois 581. I have a few questions. I have read that the planet is considered to have enough gravity to hold an atmosphere. How do we know if this planet has gravity and or an atmosphere? How far away from its sun is the planet? What would it be like on a planet which has a 37-day orbit? Which general direction in our night sky is this star system? I know I can't see it, but I just want to know which way it is. Oh, and how old is the planet?
Okay, so I think Marie's obviously hoping that by bringing in the infinite current cake to Jod Pub, that gets her free questions, or however many questions there are here.
There's four, a fair few. Five. Yeah.
Okay, at least they're all on the same topic, so we'll go for it. Yeah, I mean, this was a really exciting result just recently, which is obviously in this general area of finding planets around other stars, which is a big topic of research in astronomy these days. So this is actually from the Lick-Carnegie Exoplanet Survey, which is a paper that was published by Stephen Vogt et al. Recently. And what they've done is they've took basically 11 years worth of observations of what are called radial velocities, which is where they are measuring the motion of this star around which this planet and others are orbiting. And they can measure the shifts in the positions of lines in the spectrum of the star to ridiculous accuracy. I mean, it's amazing what's possible with these sorts of instruments. And actually, the data that they were presented in this paper was taken with the Keck telescope on Hawaii. Now, the period of the planet is 37 days, as she mentioned. So that's, if you sort of compare that to the periods of planets around our sun, you know, our period is about 365 days, period of Mercury is about 88 days. So the period of this planet of 37 days is quite a short period. That puts it much closer to its sun, its star, if you like, than we are to our sun. It's actually at a distance of about a seventh or so of an astronomical unit, which is about a seventh the distance between the Earth and the sun. So it's much closer to its sun than we are. Its star is actually not as massive as our sun. It's about a third the mass of our sun, which makes it rather fainter. But when we measure the properties of this planet, what we're doing is we're sort of looking at how this star wobbles. So you're probably aware that you know, as planets orbit the sun, if you were at school, you might have been told the sun stays still. And the planets all move around it. What actually happens is that they all orbit a common centre of mass. So in fact, the star at the centre of the system is wobbling in sympathy with the sort of motion of the planets around it. Much smaller wobble than the sort of orbit of the planets, but all the same, it wobbles, and we can measure that with these shifts of these Doppler shifts of these lines in its spectrum. If you think about the fact that it's the gravity of the planet that's causing the sort of sympathetic wobble of the star, because the planets are much less massive than the star, then they cause a very, you know, relatively tiny motion in the star. When you use this technique, because we don't really know what the inclination of the orbit is relative to us, we don't know whether we're sort of seeing it more edge on or more face on, then all these measurements give us a sort of lower limit on the mass, a minimum mass for the planet. And it looks like the minimum mass for this planet is about three or four times the mass of the Earth. So, of course, one of the things we're interested in here is finding planets like the Earth, because if you're excited about whether there's life on other planets, you might want to find a planet like the Earth. So here's one that's getting like the Earth in terms of its mass, at least taking the fact that we've got the lower limit on the mass here. But the other thing about life, looking for life on it, is it going to be too hot? Is it going to be too cold? And this is where this Goldilocks zone comes in, because anybody who knows the Goldilocks fairy story knows that Goldilocks was eating porridge, and, you know, baby bear's porridge and mummy bear's porridge and so on. And some porridge was too hot and some porridge was too cold, and then she found the porridge that was just right. So in this case, is the position of the planet in a position where it's neither too hot nor too cold, and in fact you can have liquid water, for example, which would perhaps make the planet habitable in the same sense as the Earth is habitable. And it looks like, although this planet is much closer to its star than we are to the sun, because this star is not as massive as our sun and therefore not as hot and bright, it is actually in the Goldilocks zone. It is in the habitable zone for this star. So it could well be habitable. Now, actually, Marie asks questions about, she says, is the planet considered to have enough gravity to hold an atmosphere? How do we know it's got gravity and or an atmosphere? Well, we know it's got gravity because it's got mass. So anything that's got mass will have gravity. We can estimate its mass from the amount of wobble in the star. So actually, our feeling about it having gravity, we know what its mass is. That will give us a feel for its gravity. In terms of its surface gravity, if you were walking about on the surface of this planet, you'd want to know how hard you were pulled down to the ground, and it would be that force that would tell you whether it could hold onto an atmosphere or not. Is the gravity strong enough to hold onto an atmosphere like the Earth says, or is it not high enough? So, for example, like the Moon, its atmosphere would leak out into space, basically. Well, depending on what you assume the composition of the planet is, it looks like it's the gravitational acceleration at its surface is just a little bit more than that of the Earth, maybe between about, maybe not more than about twice that of the Earth, about the same to about twice that of the Earth. So yeah, we've got a fair idea what the gravity of the planet would be, and therefore we think it could hold on to an atmosphere. We don't know that it has got an atmosphere. Probably does, because it could probably hold on to it. We don't know that it has. The atmosphere could well be studied if it turned out that it passed in front of its star. Now, I'm not sure that this is the case in this particular example, but it is the case in other examples where if you can get an eclipse where the planet passes in front of the star, in between us and its star, then we can actually see the light from the star as it passes through the atmosphere of the planet, and we can actually work out what the atmosphere is made of. So, in this case, we believe it probably would have an atmosphere. We don't know anything much about that at the moment. She's asked how far away it is. Well, we've covered from its star, we've covered that. What would it be like on a planet which has a 37-day orbit? Well, the year only lasts 37 days, so that's one difference. But the really weird thing about this is that it looks like it's actually close enough to its star for it to be tidally locked, which means that the same thing would have happened to it as has happened to the Moon in its orbit around the Earth. So you'll know that the Moon only presents one face towards us. So we always see one side of the Moon. We see the same pattern of light and dark on the Moon every night when the Moon's up. We don't see the other side of the Moon, the so-called far side of the Moon, not the dark side of the Moon. It's the far side of the Moon. And that's because it's basically the tidal forces, the gravitational forces between the Earth and the Moon, have locked it so that one face is always towards us. We think that will have happened for this planet. It's so close to its star. So one side of this planet will always be facing towards the star and the other side facing away. So one side will always be in daylight, the other side will always be in the dark, which is a pretty weird place to live. One side will be hot, one side will be cold. And I guess, you know, I imagine that people would be, if there were anybody living on it, they'd be all clamouring to live somewhere near the Terminator, the sort of region between the hot bit and the cold bit, and maybe they could travel between the two relatively easily to get a bit of a break from the...
A Goldilocks zone on the planet itself.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it may well be that there's a sort of habitable zone on the planet that's near that sort of Terminator between the dark side and the light side. So an interesting place. The temperature, well... You can sort of work out what the sort of equilibrium temperature on the planet would be by sort of thinking about how far away it is from the star, thinking about how much energy gets absorbed, how much gets radiated away, and work out a typical average temperature. That turns out to be relatively cold, sort of about 50 degrees Celsius below zero. Mm. So now that would be chilly, right? But even on the Earth, our equilibrium temperature should be about 20 degrees below zero. And clearly it isn't. It's warmer than that. It's maybe 10 degrees or so above zero on average. So why is that? Well, it's because we've got a greenhouse effect operating. So the atmosphere is like a nice warm blanket that keeps the Earth warmer than it would otherwise be. And probably there'd be a similar sort of greenhouse effect operating on this planet. So in fact, it's likely that it would be warmer than that estimate. So we do think that it would be, conditions might be reasonable despite all these weird things. We don't know whether there's life on this planet. It could be habitable. It looks like the conditions are habitable. We haven't found life, despite, you know, some of the sort of ways in which some of this was reported in the media, which gave the sort of impression that we were almost sure there was life on it. We're certainly not sure about that. Another question, how old is the planet? Well, hard to tell how old the planet is, but we typically would think that the planet would be about the same age as the star. They probably form in the same sort of process as the star forms. And it looks like, from various properties of the star, it looks like its age might be about 4 billion years. So, you know, it's not too dissimilar to the Earth, which is about 5 billion. Now, finally, what direction is it? Is it in the night sky? And she says, I know I can't see it, but I just want to know which way. Well, in terms of whether you can see it or not, you couldn't see it with the unaided eye. Its brightness, for those of you who know the astronomical systems, its magnitude is about 10.6. which makes it about 5 magnitudes fainter than the faintest star you can see without a telescope or binoculars. So that makes it about 100 times fainter than what you could see with the unaided eye. But you could see it with a telescope and maybe a reasonable pair of binoculars. It's actually in the constellation of Libra. Now, for those of you who are astrologically inclined, Sure, we don't have too many of those in the Jodcast listenership.
Oh, I can't imagine who would be what, who know where Libra is.
but Libra is a zodiacal constellation. The sun does go through Libra. At the moment, it's just to the left of the sun. So Libra is just to the left of the sun. So the sun's just set at the time we're recording this here, or just about to set at the time we're recording it here in the Jodcast studio. And so Libra will just be setting just after the sun at this time of year. So it would be possible to look it up. And if you're really interested, it's at a right ascension of 15 hours and 19 minutes and a declination of minus 7 degrees. But it's just to the left of the sun at the moment. So it might be worth looking out for if you've got a little telescope.
Or a good excuse to go to your local astronomy club.
Yep, that's absolutely. That's where Gliese 581 is with its little family of planets.
Well, I think that's all the questions answered. So we'd like to say thank you to all the listeners for writing in their questions. And also thank you for Tim for answering them.